Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. How well did France adapt to economic and social change in the 1970s, 1980s and 1990s? In this edition of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black, author of the forthcoming France, A Short History, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about French reforms and continuities from Georges Pompidou to François Hollande.
Professor Jeremy Black, the 30 years after 1945 in France are sometimes referred to as the Trente Glorieuses, the Glorious 30. It's often a reference to higher living standards and economic growth, which comes to an end with the oil crisis of the early 70s. Is it fair to look on this time as exceptional in French history?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, there had been significant economic growth during the 19th century, but in terms of the sustained pattern and the way in which the benefits were spread across society, then I think the 30 glorious years was very significant indeed. And unfortunately, as in other countries, it built up expectations that prosperity would be, as it were, permanently hardwired into the system, and also built up what were really, in many respects, unsustainable aggregate expenditure patterns. Now, those were, you might argue, that individual aspects of those, whether you're thinking of social welfare or foreign policy defence, were sustainable, but the aggregate was not sustainable. And I think you see that across the world in the 1970s and 80s.
Of course, France wasn't alone in the post-war period of having a period of sustained economic growth. The West Germans speak of the Wirtschaftswunder in the same period. Was there anything about the French period of growth that sowed the seeds, if not of its destruction, then at least for the difficult periods of the 70s, 80s that followed?
Yes, I mean, I think that what I would argue is that France, like Britain, put the state too much at the forefront of economic activity and regulation. I think Erhard in particular, as economic minister under Adenauer and then subsequently as federal chancellor, was a much more shrewd understander of how economic developments occurred. And you develop, obviously, with the either, if you like, the Christian Democrat sort of Gaullist style paternalism notions that you have to support certain industries because they're French, that you have to sustain a certain level of social expenditure because you want to keep the working class away from the communists. And, you know, you've got the same sort of attitudes in Britain in the late 40s and 50s and 60s and into the early 70s. And ultimately, all of these political strategies were much more dependent on the economics and the financial markets. And as yet, the kind of sort of spending the future that you see at the present moment with astonishing printing of financial instruments was not, whether it's sustainable at the moment is a matter of opinion. It certainly wasn't the recourse that was possible for the period. There had to be real economic growth. And unfortunately, politicians didn't really understand how fragile that could be in a heavily regulated environment.
How relevant was the power of the communists, which even in 1969, they were still getting over 20% of the vote in the presidential election? How significant were the communists in the trade union movement and the power of trade unions? And although not in power, there were centre-right presidents throughout the Fifth Republic until Mitterrand in the 1980s. Nevertheless, to what extent do these rather dirigist capitalist policies keep the left out of power, or to what extent do they make actually France quite a left-wing country without the left-wing actually being in office?
Well, I think to a certain extent the latter. I mean, you could argue statism. I mean, you know, one of the great problems we have, and as you know, it's a problem with in which neither left-wing nor right-wing commentators have covered themselves with much glory, is their habit of readily allocating a set of values to what is a true or earth state of the left or equivalently the right, and then seeing their own country, its history, its future, and that of other countries accordingly. So in France, you might say that a problem is the very significant strength of the left, and you see that, for example, when the Barre government in 79 tries to restructure the steel industry, proposes to lay off 20,000 workers, that leads to mass agitation, it has to back down, it helps, that in fact I think helps to cause the background to Mitterrand's victory. I mean, there are many other factors, but that's I think a factor in 81. But you could say that that's to do with the classic problem of the state running things, whoever's running it. I mean, in a way, you could take the attitude, I mean, should the state really have been dealing with, you know, the size of the steel industry? And I think so that I think there is a problem, and I think that the problem is compounded, as you say, by Communist Party. It's compounded by, which has its own trade unions, it's compounded by the socialists, but it is also a question of the assumption which the French really become quite habituated to, that the state will solve the problems, and that then of course focuses possibly excessive expectation as well as authority and power on the role of the state.
Well, in 1969, as we were discussing last week, President de Gaulle stands down, having lost a referendum. Georges Pompidou becomes the new president. Is there a change of tone with Pompidou, or actually a change of policy and direction?
Well, both to an extent. I mean, first of all, I mean, Pompidou wins a very good majority, 57.6% of the vote, which is, you know, is very, very good. There's, in part, that's a reaction against 68. It's a reaction against the signs of instability. It's a matter of an expression of grave suspicion about the socialists. It's a consolidation of the right around an anti-left-wing candidate. Pompidou himself, as you say, a change of tone. There is not the astringency of de Gaulle, nor indeed the arrogance. A change of policy, yes, in a number of respects. I mean, from the point of view of Britain, I mean, one of the most significant, of course, is that Pompidou wants Britain into the European Economic Community whilst de Gaulle had wanted it out. Now, I mean, his reason is power politics. He is worried about the growing strength of West Germany economically and within the EEC. He is also specifically anxious about Ostpolitik, the West German reaching out to Eastern Europe. And he is very much, I mean, the French presidency is classically very focused on foreign policy and military matters. He is very anxious about that, and he sees British entry into the EEC as a way of redressing an overly powerful West Germany. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that he was probably the most Anglophile of all the presidents of the Fifth Republic. So yes, I mean, I think Pompidou is different, very different to de Gaulle. He's not terribly well, of course. He's a heavy smoker, but he does know politics. He has been prime minister for a long time. He actually knows, in some respects, politics in terms of getting business through better than de Gaulle does, and he didn't have the illusion that he was somebody washed up from ancien regime Versailles. So I personally think Pompidou was rather an impressive figure. And he was certainly, if you think about the right-wing figures of the early 1970s, because he was president from 69 to 74, if you compare him with Edward Heath or Richard Nixon, I think Georges Pompidou was the most impressive of the right-wing leaders.
Well, sadly, it was Pompidou's fate to die in office, and to be succeeded by Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. From a British perspective, Giscard d'Estaing seems to have the kind of haughty disdain that a certain sort of British person associates with a certain sort of French aristocrat. Is that British caricature misplaced?
Giscard d'Estaing liked to see himself as a French aristocrat. Of course, his family was quite a reviste. I think d'Estaing was an arrogant man. I don't think it mattered what his social background was. As you say, I mean, president from 74 to 81, so he serves out a full time. He beats Mitterrand in 74 with only 50.8% of the vote, so very narrowly ahead, and he's very much challenged by the economic crisis, and like many figures challenged by economic crisis, he tries to grandstand on the world scale. I think that's irritating to a lot of people. It wasn't just irritating to British leaders. And, of course, ultimately it irritated the French. It's worth bearing in mind that he was kicked out in 81 by Mitterrand when Mitterrand had his return match.
One sense of the kind of the grandeur of France that Giscard d'Estaing tried to cling to was in his relations with Francophone Africa, and particularly his relations with Jean Bedel Bokassa, the dictator in the Central African Republic, emperor, we might even call him, if taking him at his own estimation. What was the nature of that extraordinary relationship? And perhaps for listeners who don't know, you could say something about the affair of the diamonds.
Oh, yes. I mean, I remember doing I was in Paris extensively doing archival research in 79, in 80, and in 81, in fact, during the election campaign in 81. And I remember a lot of the lampposts near the Archives Nationales had sort of pictures of diamonds, you know, on them. And I remember also the election posters for Giscard, and his opponents had gone around putting diamonds in place of the corneas on his eyes. I mean, essentially, Bokassa was a, you know, Idi Amin, but much worse, if that was possible, but it was. And he was dictator from 66 to 79. He was a classic example of the figures that came to power in French Africa after most of it gained independence in 1960. And these people were propped up by the French government in many senses in return for them making available their assets, mineral mines, for example, at a knockdown rate. And of course, the French didn't just do that in the case of Francophone Africa. They also did it very classically with President Mobutu of Zaire. The French, in fact, sent troops to help President Mobutu against opponents. And they generally followed a very expansionist policy in Africa. I mean, France, for example, backed Biafra in its attempt to break away from Nigeria. And that was very much seen as an attempt to do down British Africa, etc., etc. Well, we can leave out the Anglo-French component. If you're just looking at it from a French perspective, this seemed to be disgusting. Bokassa, who was rumoured to take part in cannibalism, certainly not a very nice man, was probably beyond the pale. Interestingly enough, loads of the other dictators were not much better. And the corruption, the giving of generous presents to French leaders was part of the stock in trade of that relationship. It went on. I mean, as you know, Mitterrand himself was very closely related through Elf Aquitaine to getting money out of French Africa, which then went into the Socialist Party funds. So the whole political system stunk, and this particularly good politician. I mean, you know, the story, I mean, whether it's true or not, I mean, you know, the story that I remember circulating whilst I was there on one of my trips was of Giscard attempting to show his popularity by taking the metro, only for it to be revealed before the attendant journalist he didn't know how to buy a ticket from the machine. And of course, that's rather like the story told about Curzon, you know, being told when he wanted to be leader of the Conservative Party and therefore Prime Minister in 23 that he ought to do the popular thing, was getting on a bus. And when the conductor came along saying to the driver, well, take the conductor, take this bus to Mayfair. Whether true or false, it doesn't matter. In one level, because it captured the way that the politician was portrayed. And one of the sadnesses of that kind of figure is that Giscard d'Estaing completely lacked the popular nature of the ability to be a man of the people, which Jacques Chirac, who had relaunched the Gaullist movement in 1976, became mayor of Paris in 1977 and was much better at the glad-handing and all the rest of it. And to an extent, I think this has always been a problem that, you know, at the present moment, as you know, if you argue that politicians should be accountable to the public mood and et cetera, et cetera, you're decried as a populist and people sort of lather you with the implication that you're a supporter of Donald Trump. I don't think that's true for a second. I think it's reasonable in any democratic state to feel that the politicians care about the members of the public that they're representing, care about their views. And Giscard d'Estaing was not very good at that. Let's just leave it like that.
Well, Giscard was not very good at that. Chirac had a bit more of the popular touch. What was the nature of the rivalry, bitter rivalry, lifetime rivalry between Giscard and Jacques Chirac? Was it just purely personal, or was there a generally different political agenda?
Well, it was personal to an extent, very much to an extent. I mean, history plays a role in the sense that about a sixth of those who voted for Chirac in 81 in the first round voted for Mitterrand in the second round. So Giscard blamed Chirac for his defeat because Mitterrand only won by 51.75% of the vote. But it also, I mean, there is a sort of style of politics which related in a way to policies. And if you want to think in British terms, all comparisons are dangerous. But if it helps leaders, if it helps listeners, you can think of Valéry Giscard d'Estaing as a kind of Roy Jenkins figure, a sort of poser who stood for nothing much but himself, because they shared the habit of being womanizers. And you can think of Chirac as being, in many respects, although they had differences, of being closer to Margaret Thatcher.
Well, one area, I'm interested, you mentioned Roy Jenkins, one area of these superficial similarity between Giscard d'Estaing and Roy Jenkins is support for more permissive legislation. Abortion is legalised, controversially, in 1975. Is there a sense that the swinging 60s happened in France a decade or so after they did in Britain? The death penalty wasn't actually abolished in France until Mitterrand was president in
1981. And in fact, a lot of it is after Mitterrand. Because the abolition of the death penalty is 81, the decriminalisation of homosexual acts, loosening of immigration regulations, all of that is really subsequent to Mitterrand's victory. And I think it's fair to say also it's worth, you know, that you can link that to Mitterrand's move against church schools.
Let's talk about Mitterrand now. And we can't really deal with Mitterrand or the president until we say something about his past, his checkered past, be fair to say. I suppose we should split it into two phases. The phase where he's got some very questionable friends on the on the right, the far right, his role in Vichy.
Linked with people who were involved in the Holocaust. I mean, Mitterrand's a piece of shit. I mean, there's no two ways about it. And if that offends some listeners, then they ought to really think quite hard about the nature of the person that the Fifth Republic threw up as a president and then re-elected.
So, particularly for listeners who maybe have a hazy idea as to what Mitterrand was doing in his earlier years, what is the charge sheet against him?
The charge sheet against him is one in which he, during World War II, had a distinctly ambivalent position under Vichy. That's one way of looking at it. And that he had close links with people whom were involved in the Holocaust. And subsequently, after the war, he was somebody who downplayed what had happened, was not willing to move against some of these really rather vile individuals, and you only really get France moving into an apologetic move after Chirac takes over. So one of Mitterrand's friends, for example, René Bousquet, had been wartime chief of police in the occupied zone and had played a major role in arresting Jews and sending them off to the extermination camps. Another person, Maurice Papon, who was wartime Secretary General of the Prefecture of the Gironde, and played a major role in the same activity, was only arrested after Mitterrand's death. So personally, you know, I do expect politicians to have a degree of integrity, and I personally think Mitterrand was contemptible.
That said, how on earth did he come to lead the Socialists for so long? Did the Socialist Party not take an interest in his the earlier phase of his life?
I think it's fair to say that the kind of monumental cover-up that you see in France after the war benefited people like Mitterrand. Second of all, you know, he makes himself a fixture of the Socialists in the 1950s, and the French system is, of course, where people just tend to hang around in politics in a way that many other countries, you know, I mean, let's face it, many other countries, after you've lost a couple of shots at being president, that might well be regarded as, you know, your time's up, chum. And also his self-estimation took in a fair number of people, or they found it convenient to invest in him, as it were. Mm. And of course, the fact of the matter was that Giscard d'Estaing had made himself unpopular, the economic situation was bad, and Mitterrand, who really was a ultimately a you know, I saw him in action once. I mean, he was a very self-obsessed and for himself politician. He was brilliantly good at being, I mean, you know, the description of him as like a sphinx. He was brilliantly good at focusing the hopes of lots of other people that he would forward their agenda. And he was very good at that. And of course, that's one of the great political skills. I mean, you know, I said earlier, integrity, in my view, is something that I think one should have. I'm afraid to say, actually, integrity is generally a very bad thing to have if you wish to win an election.
Well, he did win the election and became...
And he then got re-elected, of course.
Yes, and he, I mean, he's elected on quite a radical left agenda, almost, so he becomes president in 1981, and really takes France initially in the opposite direction to which Margaret Thatcher takes Britain. There are nationalisations, all sorts of exchange controls still very much in place, and then does this extraordinary U-turn in 1983. Is this the mark of a man who learned from mistakes, or is this the mark of a charlatan?
Well, I think a mixture of... I mean, he was an opportunist rather than a charlatan, I think. I think, first of all, you're absolutely right. I mean, what happens is he consolidates his presidential election by holding legislative elections. The Socialists had already raised the minimum wage, family allowances, and low-income housing subsidies. So they'd, you know, bribed lots of the electors on the never-never, and they alliance with the communists, but nevertheless, as you correctly say, he goes leftwards. Bars on popularity has led, convinced him that, you know, economic restructuring isn't on. And on top of that, the socialists are very strong in the traditional historic industry areas. You know, coal, steel and shipbuilding, some places like Lille, for example. And as you say, a determined attempt was made to control manufacturing, financial system, large-scale nationalisations in 82, exchange controls, wealth taxes introduced. And, you know, it's a sort of one-country siege economy. And that's just not possible, not least because West Germany has seen Helmut Kohl gaining power in 1982 with the right-wing Christian Democrats, and they're not pleased about it. And, you know, the French have to pay some attention. I mean, obviously, they're brilliant at manipulating the Germans, but you get a change of government in Germany, they do have to pay some attention. And on top of that, inflation is rising in France, unemployment is rising because this economic illiteracy is not working. There are strikes, there's demonstrations, a business crisis, pressure on the franc within the European, the EMS, the European Monetary System, a large-scale movement of currency abroad. So Mitterrand decides to, on a reversal of policy, appears to have decided on that in June 82 already, but typically with Mitterrand trying to play all sides of the square, he only commits himself after the socialists did badly in the municipal elections in March 83. And then what he does is he introduces elements of the bar policy that he had attacked when standing in 1981. So, you know, the idea of a distinctive French path to socialism is no longer the goal, or the rhetoric of policy. Mitterrand breaks with the left. He instead presses for a mixed economy. Moray resigns as prime minister in 84, and, you know, a technocrat, Laurent Fabius, is brought in as a self-conscious modernizer, the idea that he's going to help private business and all the rest of it. So yes, there is a significant change in the sort of readings of politics, and then Mitterrand is pushed even further by, first of all, the big demonstration of conservative strength led by Chirac in June 84, about a million people march in Paris against the government's attempts to sort of marginalise the private Catholic schools. And then Chirac becomes Prime Minister, having won the National Assembly elections in 86. So that marvellous French phase of cohabitation with Mitterrand as President and Chirac as Prime Minister goes on in this first instance till 88.
And given all of that, why is it, or how is it, that François Mitterrand wins re-election as President?
Oh, well, he's brilliant in 88. He's absolutely brilliant. What he manages to do is to blame everything that's unpopular in France on Chirac and to claim that he's sort of above politics. Indeed, he presents himself as La Force Tranquille, the sort of quiet strength. And I think it's also fair to say that divisions among the non-left have been very important. So Barr, the candidate for the centre, plays a role, and Jean-Marie Le Pen of the Front National also plays a role. And Mitterrand as well is helped by the decline of the Communist Party. Now, if you want to might be the wrong word, because I think this is an accurate portrayal. Mitterrand almost deliberately builds up the far right under Le Pen as a way of putting pressure on and weakening support for the traditional right under Chirac. And in a way, this idea, it's either us or it's the fascists, which I think is actually, you know, the theme that you can see on a number of times more recently, becomes a stock in trade. I mean, in a way, that is very much the stock in trade of the present chap.
So we should take this opportunity to maybe talk about the
the re-emergence of the Front National, first of all under Jean-Marie Le Pen, before passing through the family. Should we just see the Front National as really a continuation of the Croix de Feu, Action Française, the various Algerian nationalist groups?
It's a mass party in the way they aren't. I mean, so, for example, in 88, Jean-Marie Le Pen, on the first ballot, got 14.4%. I mean, you know, that's significant. So it's not, you know, you're talking about a relatively large group of people, and it reflects a range of political opinion and activism. There are, as it were, people who are supporters of or carrying the flag for Vichy and for its progenitors. There are also sort of disgruntled conservatives and disgruntled socialists and disgruntled communists. I mean, in some respects, Le Pen's party plays brilliantly to working class discontent, anger about the decline of traditional industries, an argument that nobody cares about us, and a deep disquiet about rising unemployment, and in the context of that, opposition to immigration. So, for example, in the town of Dreux, the Front National sort of shocks people by winning the municipal elections in 1983. But, you know, what you've got in Dreux is the context of opposition to immigration and economic problems. So I think there's a whole host of things here. And I think it's, in a way, there is this volatility with the traditional alignments in which, shall we say, the early 1960s, in which a large chunk of the working class had been very much either communist or socialist or Gaullist. And that is still the case for a lot of people in the late 80s, but a percentage of those of each of those groups is volatile, and a percentage of each of those groups is willing to be swayed. I mean, I sat to think that Jean-Marie Le Pen is a horrible piece of work. He's still alive, of course. But again, like Mitterrand, he was brilliant at enabling people to focus their differing anxieties, their differing hopes, their differing expectations on him.
So we have that, and then we find that the more mainstream right, in the guise of Jacques Chirac, becomes president. Does Chirac really offer some?
We've jumped on to after Mitterrand dies.
Yes, we have. Sorry. So we're now in the Chirac presidency. Does Chirac bring something new, or is it reheated? The reheated works of first Pompidou and then Giscard d'Estaing?
Well, I mean, let's just, for the benefit of the listeners who might not be moving as quickly as you are, Graham, Chirac wins in 95, okay? So he becomes president for the first time. He's been prime minister, as we know. So an issue that Mitterrand hadn't really taken seriously is that of trying to reduce government expenditure. And what actually happens is Alain Juppé, the prime minister appointed by Chirac, with Chirac's backing, tries to push through cuts in expenditure. This results in mass demonstrations and, what a surprise, leads in 1997 to the defeat of the government at the election. This defeat forces Chirac to back to so-called cohabitation with the socialists, with Lionel Jospin becoming prime minister. And that, of course, is a problem. So that, in a way, Chirac is compromised in his domestic politics. The system doesn't work very well. And in a way, that exacerbated Chirac's preference for gesture policies, particularly in foreign policy, rather than addressing systemic problems in the economy. The socialists didn't want to address systemic problems in the economy. example, in the search for popularity, as in the rather facile way of reducing unemployment, the sort of thing, you know, sort of a, you know, that would get you probably a first-class degree in economics and nation's economy. The socialist government capped weekly working hours at 35 hours.
We're talking a lot about political developments, but of course social and economic developments are taking place at the same time. One statistic that always interested me is that in 1980, Margaret Thatcher's just become Prime Minister in Britain and Mitterrand is about to become President of France, the share of GDP of manufacturing in both the British and French economies was almost exactly the same. Thatcherism in Britain, the policies of Mitterrand in France, and in the 1990s, the share of manufacturing in as a percentage of GDP in Britain and France has fallen equally the same amount and are, again, at almost exactly the same level, both equally much smaller. The point of this anecdote is to suggest that sometimes the policies don't seem to have made much difference to the same result. Is there a sense that some of the problems Britain was facing in the 1980s, a more globalised world, competition from particularly from Asia in manufacturing, France was facing that too, and actually its challenges were the same, and even though it pursued a slightly different path, it ended up with similar consequences?
Well, I think certainly they're both affected by general economic and fiscal trends, and sort of interest rates, for example, or price of oil and so on. Yes, absolutely. And they're also both affected by social developments, increasingly urbanised societies, higher rates of immigration, hollowing out of parts of the rural economy, greater female role in the job market, greater interest in environmentalism, attempt to engage with new technology, which the French, of course, do very well with the TGV, the very high-speed sort of train system, the very first one in France opened between Paris and Lyon between 81 and 83, and by 90 had gone on to Brittany and Bordeaux. So, you know, you've got a whole host of things, and as you correctly say, already, and this is prior to the Chinese impact in the world economy, the impact of free market economies in East Asia, particularly Japan, but also South Korea, is very significant. And the French are also being hit more than they would possibly have liked to accept by the more effective West German manufacturing competition. So yes, I think that there are commonalities there, and there are also differences. I mean, the role of the state under Mitterrand remains more explicitly honoured than the comparator in Thatcher's Britain. And also another obvious marked contrast is the French don't have to engage in political terms with Northern Irish, Scottish or Welsh separatism, which becomes a very major factor in British politics. And I suspect this is going to shock and horrify listeners with the obsessions of the last few years. I suspect somebody writing a good perceptive history of Britain, i.e. probably nobody, looking back on the late 20th and early 21st century will probably say the British question was more important to the development of the country than relations between Britain and other members, or eventually former members of the European Union.
Well, the European question in France is it a question at all? It is on the far right, but not really elsewhere. Is it fair to say the Bond Paris Axis?
Well, the French have a referendum. Do you remember?
Yes.
That? I mean, for example, they have a referendum in May 2005. They reject the draft European Constitution by 55%. The free market of workers and jobs is particularly unpopular. But obviously the French and EU sort of expectation, or the expectation of the French elite, is that if you get a referendum result you don't like, you just ignore it.
Mm-hmm. Is it fair to say that, therefore, we're talking about an elite or an establishment project in France, but most of the rest of France has a large degree of Euroscepticism, but not actually seeking France's exit from the European Union? That desire to leave the EU does seem to be a minority position, even though scepticism is significant.
I mean, I think you can find that, certainly my experience of listening to French people is that most of them whom I listen to want a kind of France within the EU in a fashion similar to what they call the general, meaning, in other words, De Gaulle, and a kind of national position within the European Union. And, I mean, there are obviously some who are enthusiasts for greater federalism, but I think it's fair to say that many of them have a very nationalist conception of the European Union.
And that is something which exists both in the Socialist Party and the various interpretations of Gaullism and its successors.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And as well with the Front National.
Mm. Danger of speeding through from Chirac.
We have another
and well, I just want to. We will see all these figures in the long view next week. But I just want to ask some questions about the left after Mitterrand. Obviously, we have ultimately with Hollande. François Hollande becomes president, not very successfully. But meanwhile, I mean, socialist polling figures for most of the last 25 years have been very, very poor. What has gone wrong with the left in terms of its popularity in France?
Well, I think partly it's what we've been talking about already, which is the sense that the traditional right and the traditional two parties of the left, and in many respects the communists have done far worse than the socialists, incidentally, in France, have leached support away to a certain extent. That's gone to apathy. To a certain extent, it's gone to activism on the streets, the kind of gilets jaunes. To a certain extent, it's gone to the FN. And you could argue that the FN is a rather curious form of socialist party. I mean, again, that's the kind of perception that almost is worth setting an exam question on. I mean, its identity politics are different, but there's a similar kind of rather crude populism to that which you associate with a traditional form of sort of we must protect French jobs for the French, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, there's also been poor leadership. There's been the traditional way in which socialist leaders have risen to the top hasn't worked terribly well in throwing up people of talent. Although, you know, I mean, the right has not exactly been flush with talent either in France. And I think it's fair to say that the agenda has not been good for the left, because the agenda has been one of trying to adjust established expectations about living standards, working practices, which a lot of the trade unions do not want. And that, I think, has not been terribly helpful to left-wing governments that have tried to change things. So the left tends to do better when it's in opposition, as it were. You know, when it hits, you know, the shock of the rubber hitting the tarmac or the road, it causes much more of a problem when it's in government.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, François Hollande, I'm afraid to say, François Hollande not only provided innocent amusement with his personal life, rather busy personal life, but also, I mean, clearly the failures were not just those of he himself, but those of a political a set of assumptions.
And there were failures too, though, with the, in a different direction, with the government of Nicolas Sarkozy, who was elected with promises of setting free, liberalising the French economy, some of the rhetoric of Thatcherism, but not so much of the delivery. Is there just a sense of...
I think that's a very fair comment.
Yeah.
I think that Sarko was not brilliant. I mean, obviously, France was... You can always make allowances. France was hard hit by the global recession of 2008. And, you know, the British government that was in 2008, the Gordon Brown government, didn't exactly find it easy in its next election. But I think there was also a challenge to its leader was somebody who, like, very different man, but like Giscard d'Estaing, was somebody who was not easy to identify with. But on the other hand, let's be clear about this. If you look at the 6 May 2012, the second round of the election, Sarko loses by 48.4% to 51.6%. Well, you know, that's not a meltdown. Mm. I think we are apt, possibly because we like results, although I have to say, I mean, the choice between Sarko and Hollande was not exactly a brilliant one. We are apt to say, oh, well, the loser is, you know, defeated, and that's it, they're written out, and that's because we're pleased to see them go. But that, you know, he did manage to get quite close to getting the majority of the votes.
Mm. Well, we are getting close to the modern day of Emmanuel Macron. We're going to discuss him next week, but in the context of the long view of French history, and also discuss some of the areas that in this very interesting series we haven't brought up so far. For now...
Can I just say something about Macron? You were talking about the change in the left. I mean, it is worth bearing in mind that Macron had been a member of Hollande's government. And, you know, it's an example. Obviously, he's tacked considerably to the right since. But it's an example of the extent to which socialism, like the traditional Gaullist party, are brought, I suppose, like the Front National, are brought churches in their own individual ways, sometimes rather unattractively so. And, you know, it's part and parcel of this difficulty of determining how one should isolate these things. The other thing we have left out, and just something that I do think that British listeners, should be aware of, if we're talking about politics, there are lots and lots and lots of faults in British politics. But I have to tell you, the range of corruption scandals that have circulated around presidents, let alone prime ministers, under the Fifth Republic is quite remarkable. And we're not just talking about rumours, we're talking about legal investigations, we're talking about trials for corruption, etc., etc. And I do think there is something very troubling in this respect, because in every democratic society, and I'm a believer in democracy, you have to find ways to encourage the next generation to feel that they're being invited to vote in a process which is worthwhile and honest and has integrity. And if you have leaders who are corrupt, then that makes it very, very difficult. And in that context, it often is only easy to elicit support by essentially urging the voters to vote against the other side. So you'll recall the election runoff between Chirac and Le Pen, where the argument that was put to people is better to vote for the crook than the fascist. Well, I happen to think it is better to vote for a crook than a fascist, but it would have been nice if there'd been a different choice.
Well, we will look at the grandeur and corruption of France in the long view next week. For the moment, Professor Jeremy Black, whose history, France, A Short History, will be published in April,
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.